From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and today we're going to talk about cruise ships, those floating microcosms of adventure and excess and globalization, steaming around the world, humans embarking and disembarking, carrying bulky luggage, carrying invisible microbes. So it's no surprise that cruise ships were early hot zones in the coronavirus pandemic. Two of them in particular have a lot to teach us. And in a moment, we'll hear the story of what one doctor saw when he boarded both the Diamond Princess cruise ship and the Grand Princess back in March. Now, that doctor didn't know it at the time, but Carolyn Wright was also on board. She was one of the ship's 2,500 passengers who came on board the Grand Princess in San Francisco on February 21st. She was ready to have the time of her life. But a few days in, her travel partner got worried.
I wasn't too worried. She was much more scared. She was like, no, no, it's going to be big. You wait and see. And boy, she was right. I just went about my business. I just didn't really worry about it. And I was wrong on that count.
Well, halfway through the cruise on the Grand Princess, things started changing.
We could tell that they were cleaning the handrails and so forth in the public areas because they were damp. You know, you could feel the wet disinfectant. They started mandating that we had to wash our hands before we went in the buffet, but not the restaurant, just the buffet. And we were no longer able to serve ourselves. They had employees that were serving us. So those were the differences we saw in the few days before we were put into lockdown. It was a nightmare. It was so chaotic. The people on the ground were doing their best. The people at the top were totally disorganized. I understood why they were quarantining us. I thought it made sense. I didn't question that. But for me, the worst part was the lack of information. And that wasn't the crew's fault. That wasn't the captain's fault. They were trying to give us information, but they had none. We didn't know where we were going. We didn't know when we were going to get off. We didn't know what was going to happen once we got off. At first, we didn't know if anybody on our ship had it. We just were given no information. And that was the scariest part for me.
Carolyn and her friend spent 7 days quarantined in their small cabin. Then all of a sudden, they learned that the evacuation process off the Grand Princess had begun.
They just would call out, okay, rooms such and such. We had had colored tags, and so they would say, okay, blue F, you know, you're going to offload. We had been given one mask on the ship. You know, the transfer, it probably was 6 or 7 hours at least that we were wearing this mask without taking it off. They said, we're going to call you when your luggage arrives and you'll come get it. Finally, a couple hours later, they called us and they said, wear your mask. And I said, well, this mask is disgusting. It's nasty. And the lady says, oh, that's a good point. I'll put that on the list of things that we need. Social distancing, stay away from other people, don't get close, 6 feet. Yet when they transported us, they herded us like cattle onto a bus. Then they got us off the bus and they put us on an airplane, literally shoulder to shoulder with a stranger. I don't regret it. It was what it was. We didn't get sick, so at least we were lucky that way. We were blessed. Most generations go through some great crisis. Let's learn from this and be prepared for the next one.
But after all that, will there be a next cruise for Carolyn?
It's all up in the air. If everything was fine, if they came up with a treatment, then I would be more than happy to go on a cruise. But right now, I'm not really looking forward to it like I was.
Carolyn Wright lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She was a passenger on the Grand Princess cruise ship, which was finally allowed to dock in Oakland, California, on March 8th. Now, several days before that, Dr. Michael Callahan was on the government team that was leading the evacuation of the Grand Princess, and he's with us now. And Dr. Callahan, I understand that just getting on board the ship was kind of a challenge for you. How'd you do that?
Oh, hello, Meg. So the Grand Princess was a very different operation than the Diamond Princess in Japan. The Grand Princess was parked off the coast of San Francisco, between 40 and 70 miles out to sea. So the first part of that interesting operation was actually getting out there with a brand new team and training them on the way for infection control practices. It was pretty unusual.
So you were training them while you were like in a smaller boat heading out to this cruise ship that was 70 miles off the coast, and you were doing infectious disease control training at the same time?
Yes, odd as it seems, the emergency response operations of the U.S. government here, the heroes of the disaster medical assistance teams, are used to being put into harm's way and to being asked to improvise and do just-in-time training. So here we took their conventional training, usually hazmat suits for chemical exposures, and flipped them into infectious disease protection training using self-contained air handling systems known as PAPRs. These are very new. And yes, that training happened on the bouncing deck of a small Coast Guard cutter moving through deep ocean water. It was pretty interesting.
Okay, so in normal circumstances, these vast cruise ships are usually allowed to come into port. There's a gangway that comes down. People walk on and off. But you said that you were on a Coast Guard cutter in sort of bouncing seas. How did you actually get on board the ship?
So this was not part of the deal. The deal was we were to go out there on a Coast Guard cutter and be transferred to another ship and then be lifted up in the divots. It was actually a lifeboat, a very big motorized lifeboat that would move us over to the Grand Princess. We would hook into cables and be lifted to the 10th story and then walk peacefully and safely onto the ship. But no, that did not happen.
What happened?
Well, because of the high swells and because of the urgency of this operation, the team was asked to proceed and do two, we call them blue water crossings. What that really means is jumping from the Coast Guard cutter to a bobbing lifeboat, which its distance will increase from 4 to 10 feet. So you got to time that jump quite carefully. And then we moved about a kilometer, about a half mile over to the Grand. And then there was another blue water crossing. This also was not in the original plan, but they lowered a ladder down from an open door. And then my team had to make a second jump, quite risky jump, between the lifeboat and the side of the cruise ship, and then climb up that ladder, all while wearing our special containment suits, which have slippery booties and restrict our field of vision.
So you jumped across the from deck to deck, I'm counting three ships now, then to a ladder, and you climbed up the side of a cruise ship while wearing essentially what looks like hazmat gear. And that was all just to get on board the Grand Princess.
Correct. It was very breathy, very exciting.
Very breathy. You're a man of pithy expression, Dr. Callahan. I should tell folks that Dr. Callahan is the director of clinical translation, vaccine, and immunotherapy, the Immunotherapy Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital. And he participated in medical evacuations of both the Diamond Princess and the Grand Princess cruise ships. And we'll talk about the Diamond Princess in a couple of minutes. But regarding the Grand Princess, since that was the one in U.S. waters, Dr. Callahan, when you first got on board after that harrowing crossing just to get on the ship, what did you and your team first see?
Well, we view these ships as hot zones, and that's why we have to board the ship in our protective equipment, in our PAPRs, the air handling units, and we're completely covered. And we noted that the crew, of course, did not have access to the personal protective equipment, certainly not at the level. And the conditions are, as reported elsewhere, quite crowded. So our first order, because we do follow maritime law, is to introduce ourselves to the captain and to receive permission to start delivering medical care, to triage, and to really move quite quickly through a huge population of over 3,000 passengers and crew.
And so you're moving through quite quickly to do what? Did you say test, to introduce yourself, to assess the quarantine measures that were being put in place?
Disaster infectious disease practice is all about throughput. It's all about the steady, focused separation of patients from those that are critically ill, that's infected and ill, those that are infected with symptoms, those that are presumed infected because they're in the same stateroom or cabin as an infected passenger, usually a family member, and those that have reduced risk. Superimposed on all this, are there other medical problems, such as immune suppression, being elderly, having lung disease? All of this has to be put into the calculation. So we have to be quite pointed and use our experience from international COVID-19 outbreaks to really move through these patients between 4 and 7 minutes per patient through the hundreds and hundreds of patients. Well, as you know, it's well over 2,500 on the Grand Princess. So that's a lot of moving fast with just a couple teams.
Right. So the Grand Princess had set sail for its second voyage on February 21st. That was the day that Carolyn, who we heard from earlier, got on board. And I think the response teams, your response teams at least didn't get on board until well into March. So the virus had been circulating on the ship for some time. I mean, did you find deceased passengers when you got on board?
Oh, most definitely. The Grand Princess had a shorter period of incubation and what we call the acceleration phase of the infection as it moves very quickly. It hits a certain population of infectivity rate, we call it, and then it just takes off. So the Grand Princess was just beginning the acceleration rate of that infection. So there were really just, you know, just over amid 180, I believe, infected at the end of it all.
And so these people who had deceased, they were just in their cabins? The bodies were in the cabins?
Yeah. Yes. And so when you open those cabin doors, and this would also be the crew members deep below, you had to basically quickly do a verbal exam, a cursory physical exam, making sure that you did not infect your team, your disaster medical assistance team members, or the crew that was assisting you in the introductions, and then quickly sort them and let them know what's ahead.
Well, Dr. Callahan, stand by here for a second. I want to hear the rest of this story when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Dr. Michael Callahan. He's an infectious disease specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He participated in the medical evacuations of the Diamond Princess and Grand Princess cruise ships in March of this year. And he's also special assistant of COVID-19 response to this assistant U.S. Secretary of Public Health. And we're talking about what we need to learn from the experience of these particular cruise ships about the COVID-19 pandemic and what Dr. Callahan saw when he got on board. So, Dr. Callahan, we had to take a quick break there, and I'm sorry about that, but you were telling us how you just, your team, as you were moving through the ship in the first few hours, I presume, of after boarding the Grand Princess, you were going sort of room to room and you just had a couple of minutes to check sort of what the status of each passenger and crew member was, and you found some people who had been deceased already?
Well, if they were they were quite far along in their illness. There were already deceased passengers on the ship. There was a it was beginning to significantly impact crew members with about a 15% impact rate among well over 1,100 crew members. We'll come back to them later because they were quite heroic.
Yeah.
But the passengers themselves had developed a grassroots communication system, communicating with each other, letting them know we were on our way to see them, and actually self-triaging, doing a really remarkable thing, telling us, Dr. Callahan, don't see me, go see this person in cabin 22 on deck 5, and they're really ill. And so we had this really amazing network in place that was self-forming, quite remarkable. But yes, we found that our problems were not just COVID, but actually internal medicine problems, issues of rapidly adjusting heart medication, hypertensive medication, breathing medication. Some people were traveling with external cardiac assist device, known as LVADs, left ventricular assist device. That's a pump that's outside of their body. And when you opened each of these stateroom doors, you'd look at it and each one would have a surprise of a different type. So you have to, on your feet, both take care of the immediate needs of the patients, take care of the emergency public health needs to make sure this infected individual poses minimal risk, or we hope to reduce their risk, to both stateroom participants and to others on the ship, and that includes the crew. And lastly, on your feet, really adjust their medicines because they've been neglected by medical care systems because of the quarantine. So a lot of fast thinking for our team.
Wow. I just have to ask, I mean, you're prior experience in doing these emergency evacuations or interventions in the midst of an epidemic, before the Diamond Princess and the Grand Princess, had you ever done anything like that on a cruise ship?
Oh, well, no. My usual work is Ebola treatment units in West Africa or highly pathogenic flu in China, Indonesia, and throughout Southeast Asia. So this was a surreal experience, is wearing my Ebola stuff or my China flu equipment on the rather glitzy, you know, ornate but very dense environment of a luxury cruise ship.
I mean, it must have been... All of you are very professional, I'm sure, and we're focused on trying to help people. But it must have been a little, as you said, surreal to walk through, I don't know, the lounge or casino of a cruise ship, thinking that there's a massive disease outbreak while the lights are flashing and the carpet, the plush carpet, is beneath your bootied feet.
Yes, Meg, you've just underscored the insidiousness of this particular respiratory viral disease. As we say in China, it sounds better in Mandarin, but this virus is all iceberg, very little ice. That means the big problem is below the surface and hidden from you, and you really need to maintain your peripheral vision and keep, really be hyper-vigilant, both at the patient level, at the level of the groups and community. And then we treat the ship itself like a city. And we're in the city saving business in the field of mass casualty infection outbreak. So there's a lot of considerations that have to be lead to rapid decisions and the triage and the prioritization of all these different work threats.
Yeah. So I want you to tell me then a little bit more about what the employees of this floating city did. You're talking about the crew. They are very frequently underappreciated because many of them are quite invisible for most of a regular voyage. So what did they do?
Well, they're remarkable. It's a cross-section of really the global population. I would write the nationality on the sleeve of my plastic suit, you know, with a Sharpie. That's where I wrote all the medical records, because you can't bring computers or even paper into the hot zone because they're presumed contaminated. So all the medical records need to be carried someplace. And I was running out of suit. I was writing medical records on my feet, on my legs, on my back, on my co-workers' backs, you know, so there was a lot of medical records and fast doctor writing. But back to your question is, the crew was, I counted 19 nationalities, typically young, very vibrant, and very devoted to the passengers. They were heroic because they were working 18-hour shifts just because of the impact to their population. They knew cabin mates that were sick or worse had been airlifted off of the luxury liner. This would be even worse on the prior cruise ship at Japan, the Diamond Princess. But whenever we went down to the crew quarters to tend to a very ill crew member who couldn't get off the ship, you'd find people just, you know, weeping in the hallways, you know, due to the impact and the burden that was placed on their shoulders, something that they were really unprepared for.
So there was no, I mean, they were unprepared because there was no playbook for this, right? I mean, or was there a playbook for a for a massive disease outbreak like this on the cruise ship, you'd think there would be because there have been disease outbreaks before.
Yes, as long as there's been maritime travel, crews have carried infectious diseases, you know, literally from back in the days of smallpox. So we travel from the New World, from Europe to the New World on clipper ships, and over the weeks at sea across the Atlantic, it would move through the crew and then, of course, infect Native Americans and other indigenous people. So not new. It's literally, you know, about six centuries old. But to the modern cruise ships, they've always been an accelerator of infectious disease. Typically, those diseases are foodborne, a disease known as norovirus, which we're very familiar with in cruise ships, and some of the infectious bacterial diseases, like several of the special E. coli that have emerged. But nothing can approach the magnitude and dilemma of a respiratory virus disease. This pathogen is ideally suited for the really unique transmission environment of a cruise ship. The cruise ship is a skyscraper on its side. Mm. It is a city full of vulnerable populations co-located at really close densities with massive opportunities to mix in the spas, the gyms, the pools, the bars, and the 12 restaurants that were on this particular cruise ship. So it's ideally suited for transmission, particularly for respiratory viruses like COVID.
Okay. I mean, Dr. Callahan, look, we could talk to you for hours to get all the details of what you did, literally moment by moment, on the Grand Princess. But I want to jump forward a little bit because you heard that passenger, Carolyn, a little earlier say that after when they were finally organized to start disembarking from the Grand Princess, she was kind of just handed one mask and then got off the ship and felt like they were sort of all huddled together on a bus, that there wasn't actually sort of orderly social distancing in the process of getting people off the ship. Is that your recollection?
Yeah, so I'm the incident commander of the team. That means I'm the disaster medical doctor. I'm responsible for shipboard operations, and we tried to prepare both the shipboard support and our colleagues at other agencies, mostly state agencies, state of California, using the common language that we use in disasters. It's called the incident command system, and it really organizes very different levels of the operation. However, it always can be improved. And remember, this was our second operation for COVID on a cruise ship. It was the third highest concentration of COVID on the planet at that particular moment and instantly became the hotspot in the United States. So we worked both with Port of Oakland and certainly the city of San Francisco, which gets a huge shout out for their great performance. And our colleagues on the shore, they didn't sign up for this either. And the fire departments, the state health authorities, emergency medical personnel, and all the hospitals that started clearing their intensive care units to receive what could be hundreds and hundreds of infected patients. That happened very, very suddenly.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you pointed that out. So tell me then, given all that you said about what the Grand Princess represented at that moment in terms of the hotspot in the United States, looking back, what do you think is the most important thing that we should learn from what happened on board and the process of getting people off? What's our most important takeaway?
Our most important takeaway is rapid response on board the ships. The ships have been trained, be it at the corporate level, but really at the level of the captain, the leader who sets the tone and the posture for the ship, to really have a rapid response. These captains are great decision makers, but they were given a disease that was a lot tougher than, say, a typhoon at sea, and much, much different than any other infectious disease that had been encountered at this level. And so they had to advocate for their crew, most certainly, and for the safety of the passengers. But the integration of people like us, the infectious disease mass casualty responders, the disaster medical assistance teams, with shipboard operations would have further streamlined those events. And I'll tell you a positive outcome is there's been a lot of traffic from the cruise ship industry to Massachusetts General Hospital and to the assistant secretary to get better. And we did bring in another 25 cruise ships. We gave our playbook to every other nation that was contending with this problem, to include Chile, Italy, Korea, Thailand, Cambodia. So that playbook was written first on the Diamond Princess in Japan, improved somewhat with the Grand Princess, and then given from the U.S. government to anybody who needed it.
Okay, so let's talk about the Diamond Princess, right? Because that was the month before, in February. I think if I remember correctly, the first COVID positive test came back from a passenger who had disembarked in Japan, February 1st or thereabouts, on the Diamond Princess. When did you get the call that a cruise ship was going to be an epicenter of the COVID pandemic?
By the time we got the call, they were really about halfway to two-thirds of the way through what was going to be a four-week voyage. And that 80-year-old male was really the index patient. And he was on the ship for really a short period of time. He was, in follow-up reports, when we've communicated with our Hong Kong colleagues who we're very close to from prior outbreaks, like SARS. And we just asked him, and the history was he really had 2 days of symptoms, 2 days of coughing. And then he was taken off at Hong Kong. It would take some days before the Hong Kong authorities informed the captain of that, of the Diamond Princess, Captain Gennaro Arma, who was another real hero in terms of his leadership. But by the time we got called, it was day 9th of the quarantine. And by the day we got out there into Japan, when the airlift started, we deployed on day 10th and arrived in, obviously you lose time over the dateline, but we landed in Narita, that's Tokyo, on the 11th, and then raced down to start interfacing with our Japanese colleagues, Japanese disaster medical assistant team, before we boarded the ship.
Okay. Now, you worked with James Lawler, Dr. James Lawler, right? He's co-executive director of the Global Center for Health Security at the University of Nebraska. You worked with him?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. James has been my wingman for multiple Ebola outbreaks. And as we worked across different agencies of the government, him at the White House and the National Security Council, me in DARPA, which was a research and mass casualty care technology development group, we've deployed on different teams. And then this was the first time where we were actually working together. But he's really good in a disease outbreak bar fight where you have to move fast, be smart, make rapid decisions. And his institution is the shining star internationally. The University of Nebraska is a wonderful partner for any institution, but particularly the Mass General Hospital.
Yeah. He told another reporter that he got the call that you were going to go out to the Diamond Princess in Japan. He was on a plane the next day, spent $35,000 in a government grant to buy 21 pressurized containment suits for you and your fellow sort of medical evacuation team to wear. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. They're called PAPRs, and they're our global standard when working with highly dangerous pathogen infected patients.
Okay. And I'm trying to get a sense, a visual sense of what it was like on board. Did you have was there a tent set up somewhere near the ship or on the dock that was sort of a halfway point or a decontamination center for workers as they were coming on and off the ship?
Yeah, so there we adapt our disaster medical assistance, our DISMA, disaster management, to infectious disease mass casualty disasters, which James and I have worked on across several continents with. But you do need to, you know, tweak them quite a bit because these are slow rolling disasters. They're not a hurricane which hits and then goes away, or a tsunami in Indonesia, or a, you know, terrorist event. The problem is unfolding and expanding ahead of you. The problem is getting worse by the hour. So this system was, you know, basically set up very close to the ship, and we would don, that is, go through the ritualistic specialized process of putting our equipment and checking each other like you would checking your parachute or checking your dive equipment, and then proceeding onto the ship. And that's the easy part. It is later the doff where all the action is. That's when healthcare workers infect themselves or infect bystanders. But yes, that's basically right.
Okay.
The management center was right next to the ship.
Yeah, I keep coming back to the notion that, or the truth that the Diamond Princess was essentially the place where this new playbook for evacuating citizens off a cruise ship in the middle of a health disaster, you were essentially writing the playbook as you went along. Frankly speaking, I'm seeing some reports here that are saying the quarantine measures maybe weren't strict enough. They were implemented too late by both Japanese authorities or even the CDC later, that perhaps there wasn't appropriate use of masks. I mean, honestly speaking, it wasn't a perfect operation, was it?
Oh, by no means. And there's a lot of blame to go around. But the practice of disaster medicine teaches our colleagues of the future that follow in our footsteps all the lessons learned. And we're transparent and forthcoming about what we learned. And remember, that playbook was written while we were wearing these suits. So we wrote that playbook on our sleeve.
Well, I want to talk more about the language on that sleeve, especially when it came to repatriating folks as well. So Dr. Michael Callahan, stand by for a moment. We are getting a firsthand account of a physician who participated in the medical evacuations of the Diamond Princess and Grand Princess cruise ships and the lessons learned there as Carnival Cruise Lines, the world's largest cruise industry, says it wants to start setting sail again from three ports in August. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about how prisons across the country have become hotbeds of the coronavirus, of the novel coronavirus. And we want to hear from you. If you know someone who is currently incarcerated, what are they experiencing at this moment? Is the COVID-19 pandemic in the facility, the jail or prison where they are? Is it there? And what have you experienced? And what do you think the pandemic is revealing about mass incarceration in the United States? Call us and leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's program. Today, we are talking with Dr. Michael Callahan, and he's giving us his firsthand account of what it was like being on the medical evacuation team that helped passengers and crew on the Diamond Princess cruise ship in Japan in February, and the Grand Princess cruise ship that was off the coast of California in March, and the lessons learned about what it takes to get people off a ship in the middle of a public health disaster. Dr. Callahan is a physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also special assistant of COVID-19 response to the Assistant U.S. Secretary of Public Health. Now, Dr. Callahan, I've come back to this a couple of times, but it's just the visual image is so striking. When you were on board the Diamond Princess, for example, in February, I mean, these are such massive ships. The hallways are, what, a couple of thousand feet long? They're like the whole length of the ship. I mean, how much did you walk around? How many miles did you cover as you were trying to find all the passengers and crew to find out how they were doing?
Meghna, I had no idea what we were getting into. I haven't done direct cruise ship medevacs before. These ships, both the Diamond and the Grand, they're 18 stories. About 14 decks are for passengers. The remainder are for crew. They are made up of two 1,000-foot hallways, times, again, those 14 decks. So my pedometer on the Diamond Princess was about 11 miles. And the Grand Princess, it was 14 miles of walking continuously over the 44 hours of the operation.
Wow. And that the numbers are quite striking, as is the reality of what you were encountering, right? As you were saying, you were checking from room to room, trying to find out the status of each crew member, each passenger, maybe seeing even some people unconscious in their rooms. I mean, it's incredible. And then the team, the crew, all the people working on this had the challenge of getting everybody off the ship, off the Diamond Princess. And again, this was the first one in February. So how did that go?
It's great. So our position there, if my recollection was right, it was about 450 Americans. Mm-hmm. A large number of them had already been medevaced to Japanese hospitals, which we spent a lot of time following up on. They were U.S. citizens on foreign soil, separated from their loved ones who were off and on the ship, leading to extraordinary stress and real great sadness, you know, for these families, these passengers. But I also saw a lot of real bravery, you know, among the passengers. It was quite remarkable. But back to your point is, during mass casualty infection triage, there's a whole protocol and procedure that we use to rapidly divide the patients between those that need our immediate medical care, that's on scene, and are salvageable. That means that we can turn things around for them. This would be equivalent to a trauma surgeon seeing an arterial bleed and putting a pressure bandage on it. These are things that are rapidly reversed, for example, with rapid IV resuscitation, with oxygenation, and with intubation. And on the second ship, we carried a portable, a very special little 3-pound ventilator that's made by the government and is ideally suited for these purposes. So to the second point is the next group, which are ill. Mm-hmm. They are going to the hospital, but they're not ready for a ventilator. So this group is on a downward spiral, and we need to do whatever we can to change the trajectory of that spiral and buy them time. The third group is infected, minimally symptomatic, and with COVID-19, that would be the number one early symptom we always find is diarrhea or trouble with the bathroom. And this is always missed by a lot of the doctors that don't really know this disease, and that's usually followed by malaise, then fever, then the dreaded cough, which is, of course, the main mechanism of transmission. But so, too, of course, is it transmitted by all the hand-touch surfaces on the cruise ship. The last group is worried and exposed. This group we will not co-house with the infected. We will quarantine them, and that's separate from isolation. Quarantine is to put them in, for this disease, 14 days of isolation, which we try to start on the cruise ship by isolating them with a mask, with antiviral hand sanitizer, and by giving them a separate bathroom. And lastly, those that have lower risk but we're concerned about for general reasons because of their you know, they oftentimes are elderly and oftentimes are very vulnerable for diseases like HIV, organ transplant, or malignancies. Mm. So those are our groups.
Okay. So you've emphasized separate bathroom at least once or twice here in the description that you had. I really want some of the details here, because I've heard that when passengers were taken off the Diamond Princess and put on buses, right, to get to the airport where there were airplanes waiting for them to take them back to the United States. I mean, this is what you and Dr. Lawler were in charge of, right? Like, were there separate bathrooms for people on the buses or the airplanes?
No, there were not. That was our Japanese colleagues. This was a ground operation. So U.S. Incident Command loses control as soon as we left the ship. We were responsible for the disaster at the beginning. That would be the ship. And then we were responsible for the operation on the aircrafts coming back to the United States. For those, we take full responsibility, but not the buses. Terrible things happened on the buses. They were systems errors, where groups that are not understanding the flow of patients through time and through the continued spread of the infection, and that part of the program could have been dramatically improved.
Okay,
no doubt about it.
So then describe to me the retrofitted cargo airplanes do I have that right, that you were flying people back to the United States in?
Yes, Magna, most certainly. The desperation and the urgency of getting those Americans home and to break the chain of infection required that we got ourselves into that ship and separated from the ill, from the non-ill, to preserve life and prevent infections. And that has to continue on the plane. In the federal government at DARPA, we have a program called Immune Aircraft. Immune Aircraft, which was a program we led back in 2004 through 2006, and was based on highly pathogenic flu, like the old H5N1 we used to always talk about, required that the airplanes themselves be jujitsued or flipped into a conformation that would reduce infection. It's called drifting, in which case the airflow comes from the nose to the tail. And that means we load these aircraft with the least at risk, the worried, maybe exposed, up at the front of the aircraft. We put the exposed in the middle of the aircraft, separated by rows of seats, ideally. And thirdly, we isolate the infected and symptomatic at the rear, and we separate the washrooms. In this case, in a cargo aircraft, rather unfortunately, there were the use of porta potties. And Dr. Lawler chose a better airplane than I did. I got the worst of the two aircraft, and he's quite proud of his decision. He had a much easier time than I did.
Why was yours the worst of the two?
I had 189 people on my airframe and one doctor, no other help. I mean, there was people supporting the aircraft operations, but 189 folks who this time had been through 14 days of isolation in their staterooms, not a lot of activity, had run out of their normal medication and been transitioned to Japanese medication, some of which were not FDA approved. And so there's a lot of medicine going on, readjusting their medicine, using medicines that I had not seen since the 1980s, and changing the pharmacokinetics in your head to dose and making guesses on their body weight, plus providing comfort. The medical care given aboard the aircraft included 4 orthopedic injuries, 4 chest pains, including one for sure heart attack, transient ischemic attacks. This would later be associated with COVID's really nefarious ability to cause coagulation problems. That would mean clots. And we think that was unrolling right before our eyes. And then, of course, the issue of people in the darkness fumbling around the aircraft and going to the wrong bathroom and potentially infecting themselves because they went to the wrong bathroom.
Right.
That was a big problem.
Now, Dr. Callahan, I want to emphasize something. This is really important. I am not seeking to blame. I am seeking to learn here, right? And as you've said repeatedly, the playbook was being written in real time as you and the team were trying to repatriate these Americans back from Japan. But we also have to be honest. It sounds like it wasn't an ideal situation at all. I mean, a cargo airplane with seats temporarily bolted to the floor, portable potties in the back, which I've seen passengers say were, like, at times they had to shut them down or they were overflowing. And as you were saying, one doctor with 189 people with various medical needs. It sounds like there's a lot to be learned from how the repatriation happened from Japanese soil to U.S. soil.
Right. And disaster medicine doctors, in particular, the very small community of disaster infectious disease doctors, we're very transparent and honest with lessons learned because the consequences are so high. So we are completely forthcoming with the things that we learned in our Ebola treatment units in Africa, in our Chinese ICUs where we saw our first COVID patients, and on our first cruise ship, which made the second cruise ship go so much better. The planes are a problem, but remember, this is the first time in the history of history that an American team had deployed under urgent circumstances for an unprecedented virus that was of magnificent infectivity. And the big priority was to prevent further infections, to extricate those Americans who had already been through all of this trauma and stress and whose lives were at immediate risk from this terrible disease. And getting them onto that airplane, even though it was not the best airplane, that was the right decision. That airplane was available, and a commercial aircraft was not available at that moment in time.
It sounds like is it safe to say you've never experienced anything like this, even in all of your medical adventures around the world?
No, I was surprised at how quickly the plans that we had written up in Washington, D.C. and tested with other diseases overseas for the U.S. military using Boeing and Lockheed aircraft, how poorly they adapted to this airframe because of the sheer number of patients that became symptomatic on the flight. So they land, you know, when we screened everybody, we thermo-checked everybody. That means we took their temperature. We did another follow-up exam. By this time, they were familiar. Many of them were sick of listening to me by that time. So we wanted them all to get as comfortable as they could for the 13-hour flight back to the United States. And this, you know, the aisles were very jammed. So it was certainly imperfect. And I bet the people that follow me will do a better job.
Well, Dr. Callahan, I have to say, I could talk to you for hours about this. This is so fascinating. But I've one last question for you. Given all that you've described and all that you've experienced on these two cruise ships, what do you think about the fact that Carnival Cruise Line says it wants to start sailing again from three ports as early as August?
Wow. Brave. They, you know, this is the that corporation has contacted us at the Massachusetts General Hospital and separately me at the Assistant Secretary's Office, the Disaster Response Office of the U.S. government, where FEMA and National Disaster Medical Assistance sits. And we have already pushed forward some standard operating procedures and then disaster response procedures to these large cruise ship lines, of which Carnival is just one. If they implement those things, they will significantly improve these operations. But quite frankly, Magna, we're just starting this pandemic. It needs to, it's going to still hit the world's poor. It will be back on cruise ships, I am certain. And so this industry needs to be prepared for that.
Well, Dr. Michael Callahan is an infectious disease specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he participated in the medical evacuations of the Diamond Princess and Grand Princess cruise ships. Dr. Callahan, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Very good, Magna. Thank you.
All right. Well, we want to spend a couple of the last minutes of the show here talking about what Carnival Cruise Lines and the cruise industry is thinking about when it can reopen and set sail again. So joining us now from Miami is Taylor Dolvin. She's Miami Herald business reporter covering the tourism industry. Hi there, Taylor.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for your patience. You can imagine how fascinating it was to talk to Dr. Callahan. But tell me a little bit more about why Carnival, it's the leading cruise line in the industry, why the industry is saying it wants to start setting sail late this summer.
Yeah, so the majority of companies have said they're going to be canceling cruises through mid-June. It's important to note that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are preventing any cruises through July 24th at the earliest. And so this week, we heard Carnival Cruise Line come out and say, okay, we're going to cancel all of our cruises even after that, through August 31st. But eight of our 27 ships are going to start sailing on August 1st, from Miami, from Port Canaveral, and from Galveston, Texas. They haven't announced any new protocols, any enhanced protections for crew and passengers to protect them from COVID-19, but that's their plan as of now, to start sailing those eight ships.
Wait, did I hear
from
you
U.S. ports.
Taylor, did I hear you properly? They haven't yet announced any enhanced protocols.
No, they have not.
Okay, as we heard just Dr. Callahan say that those protocols are in existence, he'd be more than happy to tell them all about it, I'm sure. How much of a hit has the industry taken, and do they think that they can recover from this?
Oh, it's an unprecedented hit. I mean, we never in the history of the industry has cruising been halted. Starting on March 13th, the industry opted to stop all new cruises and cancel for just 30 days. That's now been extended by the CDC through July 24th at the earliest. But it's incredible. There's no revenue coming in from onboard revenue, which is like purchases on these ships, which accounts for one third of the company's income. So they've had to do layoffs, furloughs. They're really trying to get investments, private investments, and hang in there.
Huh. And we've got about 30 seconds left, Taylor. Has the industry come to terms with the role that it might have played by keeping ships cruising and not quarantining passengers as soon as they could back in February?
No, not that I've heard yet. The industry group CLIA is still saying, you know, we're being singled out, and points at hotels and airplanes as other points of infection. So really grappling with the fact that cruise ships are incredibly risky for infectious disease is still to come.
Well, Taylor Dolvin is the business reporter for the Miami Herald covering the tourism industry. She's done extensive reporting on the cruise industry, and we have links to her work at onpointradio.org. Taylor, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.